Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Showcase Studio, looking out here on Michigan Avenue. And it's Thursday. That means Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. 312-981-7200. One artist, three songs. Get them in now. 312-981-7200. We'll play them later. We're going to talk about firsts. First job, first car, first date, that kind of stuff. And we'll reminisce a little bit about that kind of stuff as well. And Skip Skipley's on the way. We're going to have another edition of Pop-Up Video coming up between Esmeralda and I. That's later in the show. 312-981-7200 is talk and text, the AAA Thursday request. And you can also follow us on Twitter, at Nick D Show. And the best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right. It is the second Thursday. Every couple of weeks, Dan Feinberg joins us. He's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print. And he joins us every couple of weeks to talk television. And there's always a lot of TV to talk about. Let's welcome Dan back to the show. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you, Nick.
All right. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Busy with lots and lots of television.
Yes. Now, have you, we always want to get progress on your DVR. how's that coming along?
I've caught up on a few additional random things for absolutely no justifiable reason. Let's see. What am I caught up on now? I'm caught up on Riverdale.
Ah, okay.
I can hear the murmur of appreciation throughout the audience. I am caught up on Starz' Counterpart. Are you watching Counterpart?
I have not caught up on that one. It's on my DVR, though. Let's talk a little bit about that first before we get back into how is it? Tell everybody what it is. J.K. Simmons, there's an alternate universe. There's two J.K. Simmonses.
That is basically the best way that I could describe it, because actually explaining the logistics of the show would be so complicated, it would take longer than to just watch the show. Basically, in Germany, there was a rift made between two different versions of reality, and people can pass to and from the two different versions of reality, which means that there are two J.K. Simmonses and two Olivia Williamses, and basically it's a spy thriller. It's a Jean Le Carré spy thriller with a interdimensional twist, and so it's two different worlds diverged about 25 years earlier, and so there are two very different versions of J.K. Simmons's character, and it's just a wonderful performance that he's giving. I mean, it's an actor's dream. It's the kind of thing that you would kill for, and
yeah,
the kind of thing you're supposed to get when you get to be Oscar winner J.K. Simmons.
Right.
Supposed to say, here, have this role. And it's very serious about the spycraft aspect of things, the John Le Carré aspect. It's also very serious about the science fiction aspects, probably to a point probably to the degree to which I would want them to be. I think probably there are sort of bigger sci-fi heads who might want things a little bit wonkier, but it's as much as I need.
Yeah.
It's not a fast-moving show. It's a deliberate show. Again, it's Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, squared, because there are two of them, and it's really good, and it is worth watching. It requires a little bit of patience, but yeah,
I'm glad to hear that. I am like this massive Olivia Williams fan. I fell so hard for her when I saw Rushmore.
Of course.
That, like, I always root for her, and I love her, and I always want more of her. Like, there's never enough. As far as I'm concerned, in the world, there's never enough Olivia Williams. And just to have the two of them, because J.K. Simmons is one of my favorite actors, the two of them in a show that sounds so intriguing, who's creatively behind it?
It's Justin Marks, who mostly has done feature writing. He's never done a TV show before, and perhaps that explains why he isn't playing necessarily by any rules. The first episode was directed by Morten Tildum, who I believe is Passengers, right? Is
mm-hmm.
that his?
Yeah.
His most recent and most esteemed credit, it's got a lot of very good prestige TV directors who have followed up subsequently. And the writers include sort of an interesting assortment of people, including Amy Berg, who's done a lot of sci-fi that people know, Aaron Levy, who worked on Mad Men, etc. One of the executive producers is La La Land and famous Oscar cutaway person Jordan Horowitz. So, you know, if you like him holding up correct envelopes saying Moonlight, you know, he executive produces this. And it's really just, it's just a great cast. So there's kind of a surprising number of people from the deceased WGN America show Manhattan, which a lot of people really enjoyed, which I really enjoyed, which was another very similarly serious, smart, involving drama. So Olivia Williams is from both shows. Harry Lloyd, also from Game of Thrones, both shows. Richard Schiff has a recurring role here. It's a very Stephen Ray. If we're picking out names, it's a really good cast. It looks great. It's fantastic looking. It's already been it was picked up for 2 seasons up front, so they're already starting production on the second season. And it's a serious show, and it does require your attention, because if you look away for too long, you will miss something important. Also, large chunks of it are in German, or, you know, middling chunks are in, enough that you have to pay attention,
basically. Okay. All right. Well, I'm looking forward to it. I'm glad to hear it's good. I mean, obviously, I was intrigued by it. I just haven't caught up on it. Speaking of stars, I am, of course, caught up on Ash versus Evil Dead, because I have my priorities. they're only 2 episodes in, and it's a half an hour. And again, you can fly through that. So, I'm loving it.
From last season.
I'm sorry.
I'm 6 episodes behind from last season.
Yeah, no, it's I love the show, and I just think they, you know, as an Evil Dead, one of those dork freak Evil Dead guys, I was very skeptical when I heard that they were going to make a TV series out of it. But when I heard Raimi directed the first episode, Tappert, Raimi, and Campbell are all, you know, on board as executive producers, they've taken, you know, the mythology and the style of the Evil Dead movies, and they've continued it on, and they're true to it. It's like a fan's dream. It really is. And it's gory as hell, and it's great. So,
well, I guess my question about it, sort of with a half a season of the second season and the third season go, is doing the same thing, because I felt like the first season and a half were basically kind of playing out the same beats over and over again, sometimes escalatingly. So I did think the second season escalated things nicely.
Yeah.
But it did feel like it was doing a lot of the same things. And I kind of wanted it to go nutty in a different direction at a certain point.
Well, it is that sort of consistent Evil Dead nuttiness that's the same now for the first 2 episodes of the third season. But I think they're doing some really interesting stuff with the characters, and they're adding new characters each season. Like the season that you're watching now, season 2, they bring in Lee Majors as his dad, and that's a really wonderful dynamic. And you know, Lucy Lawless's character changes from season to season, and in this season they bring in his long lost daughter that he didn't know he had, and they bring in like another supporting character to hang out with Pablo and Kelly, and that dynamic changes everything. And some of the characters, supporting characters, go through a lot of changes. So I appreciate that. But in terms of like nuttiness and style and gore, it's pretty consistently Evil Dead-ish, if you know what I mean.
Well, I do, and yet Army of Darkness is so different from the first two movies, and I think that's kind of why I appreciate that movie, is because they said, okay, we're going very, very far afield. And I liked that they did that in Army of Darkness, and I don't know that I've felt as if the TV series was taking as many leaps, as many dangerous leaps creatively.
Yeah. You know what? It's not quite as crazy and out there as Army of Darkness, which I love that movie, obviously. But no, they're not doing anything quite that insane. I mean, it goes pretty far, and they take some risks with the characters, but it's not, you know, Army of Darkness insane, hilarious level. Quite, but it's still very entertaining.
So. It is sitting there on my DVR, and one of these days I will get it.
Okay. It's good to hear that the other star shows are good too. The Counterpart is good as well. Now what else did you caught up on? What else on your DVR?
Well, mostly I've had 5 reviews that I've written this week. I wrote like 3 last week. And so it ends up being these huge blocks of different shows where I'm having to watch 6 and 7 and 8 episodes, like NBC's Rise. That was a 10-episode commitment, so that's 10 episodes of something on my DVR I did not get.
Got it.
I'm trying to think of other things. I'm caught up on Supergirl. Basically, what I'm caught up on are the things that don't require too much of my attention, and then for some reason Counterpart, because I felt like I wanted to catch up on that. But it's a lot of things that I can kind of watch while doing three other things.
Got it.
And so I feel like there are a lot of the dramas that maybe I haven't caught up on, but it's stuff like Scandal,
I gotcha. All right, well, you know, you mentioned that you had a lot of reviews. Before we get to some of those, and there's so many new shows that you've reviewed here that we have to get to, have you seen if I get the name wrong, it's the show on ABC where it's a magician solving crime. Is that Deception?
It is indeed Deception, or as I call it, Magic Castle, because it is basically Castle if magic.
Oh, that's very clever. That's good, man.
But that is what it is, and you do not need to know anything else about it. I have to write my review of it tomorrow, and in all likelihood, my review is going to be like three sentences long, and I'm going to be like, "Yeah, that's pretty much it." It is so totally Castle. Like, there are plot twists in the pilot that someone basically watched the structure of the Castle pilot and said, "Okay, take that completely." And since Castle did run for 10 seasons and was wildly popular, I can't like begrudge them. And because ABC hasn't had like that kind of hit since, but yeah, it's Castle if you thought that Nathan Fillion was too funny and charismatic and you wanted a much less charismatic leading man.
Yeah, that was a complaint.
That was what you wanted.
Yeah, that was a complaint of mine. I found Nathan a little too charming and good. Well, it's
you may well like Jack Cuttenworth Scott, Deception, who you may recall from Cooper Barrett's Guide to Surviving the Universe, or whatever it was actually called, Barrett's Guide to Surviving Life. It was actually pretty close to what I said it was. He keeps getting cast in shows that rely on everybody being astounded by how cool and charismatic he is, and yet he is unfortunately not those things.
Okay.
It is odd.
All right. I just, every time I would see the commercials for it, I would just think, another reason to hate the Now You See Me movies, because that's what I just think it was. It's like, were the Now You See Me movies, were they that popular that they're going to now inspire a television show where magicians solve things? I don't know.
The first one certainly was. The second one a little bit less so.
Yeah.
It has some cleverness to it. It was created by Chris Vidak, who was one of the driving forces on Chuck, which was a favorite show of mine. And he has a certain sense of nerdy fun that I appreciate. I think the leading man is a problem, and it's just so formulaically an ABC light, fizzy procedural that, you know, if it's the kind of thing you like, this is absolutely the kind of show you could have on in the background while doing other things.
Right.
It's not going to be a show people are going to get obsessed with, I don't think.
How many episodes have you seen?
I have seen 3 episodes.
Okay. All right. Well, that's enough to form an opinion.
I think so.
Yeah. All right, Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
Yeah, Dan Feinberg is with us. He is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. We always love to talk about TV. We've got a lot more TV to talk with him about, and we're going to take a quick break for the news. And after the news, we'll jump right back into the conversation and talk with Dan right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Showcase Studio right here on Michigan Avenue, and we're here till 5 a.m. Dan Feinberg joins us, and we're here till 5, and at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell. Justin Kaufman will be filling in for Steve Cochran this morning at 6, that's what's coming up here. 312-981-7200 for Talk and Tech. Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. We'll play them later. One artist, three songs. 312-981-7200 for talking text as well. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show, Facebook.com/Nick D Show for the Facebook page. Dan Feinberg is with us, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And we love to talk TV, and we will bring Dan back. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you, Nick.
Obviously, we should mention before we jump into some of your reviews and newer TV, what did you think of the Oscar telecast?
I thought it was, as these shows always are, a mixed bag. I thought it had a lot of highlights. I thought it had a few fairly low lights. And I know that you're a fan of the Jimmy Kimmel sort of man on the street stuff. What did you think of the 10-minute detour to walk across the street and shoot people with a hot dog cannon?
I found it amusing. I didn't think it was nearly as funny as what he did last year with the bus and bringing the people into the theater. And taking selfies with Denzel and stuff. I thought that was a much funnier bit. But I did laugh. I mean, Army Hammer shooting hot dogs at people, I think, is funny. So I thought, and the dude with the dude that got to introduce Tiffany Haddish and Maya Rudolph with the giant beard, I thought that was kind of fun that he got to do that introduction. So.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty brutal, especially given how very funny Tiffany Haddish and Maya Rudolph were.
Yeah, yeah.
They are spectacular.
Yeah.
I thought that the Star Wars thing was a pretty huge embarrassment, mm-hmm. and this is for a franchise that had Jar Jar Binks in a holiday special. But I thought that was just about as embarrassing as I've ever felt for any Star Wars people ever.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, that was pretty bad. But the show was long, but I thought it had highlights. It had emotional moments. The winners were all very, very predictable at this point, with the possible exception of Best Picture. But, this award season thing goes on forever, and so it takes away a lot of the amusement. You know, thank heavens that even though she's had to give speeches 750 times, Frances McDormand can still be fantastic.
Yes, yes.
So we are not worthy of Frances McDormand. No, it had highlights and lowlights. I think that they made certain mistakes in terms of overemphasizing the importance of a quote-unquote 90th anniversary. I mean, it's a birthday with a zero at the end. It's not a milestone. 100, that's a milestone. 100, you guys can go 5 hours and bring out all of the people who were amazed or still alive. But for 90, I think I might have liked something a little bit lighter on its feet in certain points, especially given how much heavy, you know, hashtag Me Too and Time's Up stuff was going to be involved anyway. Mm-hmm. But I thought that, again, Kimmel did a decent job. I suspect they're going to move away from him next year.
Yeah.
I think they need a bigger name because I think they think that the ratings are in some way tied to the host. I don't blame him for the low ratings, but I'm sure someone does.
Yeah.
So, I would expect they will go to someone bigger next year or hope they can get someone bigger next year. But Kimmel did not do badly.
No, I
don't blame him.
Yeah, now I'm a fan of Kimmel, and I thought his opening monologue was good, and he hit, you know, a lot of the right notes. And as you said, there were highlights and lowlights, and some of those speeches were pretty great. What did you think of the running gags with the jet ski and Helen Mirren and the, timing of the speeches and stuff?
I wish that it had paid off a little bit more. Basically, nobody cared. And that was the thing I don't think that Jimmy Kimmel counted on. I don't think he counted on the fact that really after like the second person, no one was going to try to win the jet ski. And so there was finally no competition because people thought it was more important to thank people than to be brief.
Yeah.
And I think that was probably a predictable failure of the gimmick, is that you weren't going to get anyone to just be like, I would really like a jet ski, because while Frances McDormand is certainly capable of giving a terse speech, she could have gotten up there and said, yeah, I want this jet ski, bye. No one wanted the jet ski enough to give up this platform, and so it fizzled, I thought, at a certain point. I would have liked for it to be more of an enticement than, sadly, it ended up being.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Rockwell got a laugh out of it because he was the first guy up there after the whole bit, and then Mark Bridges wins the jet ski, which I thought was, you know, which I think is pretty funny.
But I think ultimately more people just made jokes about how they weren't going to win the jet ski.
Right.
And attempted to win the jet ski, and
right.
I think that was probably pretty predictable.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I enjoyed it. It was very long, but it was weird because it was really, really long, but it didn't seem insufferably long to me. I've watched award shows in the past and Oscar telecasts in the past that are long that feel like insufferable, and just this will never end. And while this broadcast was undeniably way too long, it didn't feel like a chore. I kind of was enjoying watching it, even though it was, you know, like 4 hours long.
I thought they did a decent job of weaving Kimmel into the show a little bit more than sometimes you see hosts get brought back. Like, sometimes it's just you do the monologue, you do one or two things, and then time becomes of essence and they stop bringing you out there. I think that there was a feeling that this show was just going to run as long as it ran and no one was going to stop anyone from doing anything.
Yeah.
And so that meant that Kimmel got to come back and be funny a couple times during the show, and I think that probably helped the pacing. I think there were, there were a couple of those montages that were both unnecessary, but also kind of appealing. And so they were both of those two things, and you got to go, oh, okay, I like all of those supporting actress winners.
Right.
Yay, how nice to spend 2.5 minutes with them, even if that's 2.5 minutes.
Right.
I'll never get back.
I think you put your finger on it right there. Was like, you know, there were one too many, two too many, three too many montages, but they were good. That was the thing. And I enjoyed watching those montages. And, I wasn't complaining. I mean, the length was too long, but like the stuff that was in there was, most of it was good. So I didn't complain. So.
And I thought a lot of the technical people who sometimes, people who aren't actually movie fans, complain about being there. I thought, for example, the short film winners who talked about their mothers raising money, selling cupcakes.
Yeah.
That was sweet. That's
yeah.
The reason why they're on the show, is because these are people who actually, whose parents paid for the thing with cupcake money. And
right.
So you want to give those people their moment in the spotlight. And I thought a lot of those people made good use of those moments. And I do not think that Shape of Water was Guillermo del Toro's best movie by any stretch of the imagination, but he is as good a guy and as good a filmmaker and as passionate a filmmaker as one could possibly imagine.
Yep.
And so I'm happy for him to get the recognition, even if he deserved it for Pan's Labyrinth or something else.
Yeah, or Devil's Backbone, which is my favorite of his movies. I got to say this, though. The biggest cheer from my couch was when Roger Deakins finally won for Best Cinematography. I mean, it's just... I think he's the best DP on the planet right now. And if he didn't win, I would have just gone nuts.
Well, I thought his moment was great.
Yeah.
The fact that James Ivory was 89 and had never won before, that was terrific. And,
yeah.
And he was great. And also the script for Call Me By Your Name is so good.
Yeah.
Also, so completely and totally deserved. But, you know, the dude is a legend.
Yep.
And unlike Roger Deakins, if Roger Deakins hadn't won, he was going to have two more movies next year. He was going to have two more movies the year after. Going to have two more movies. But, you know, James Ivory, you want to get him up there and give him his standing ovation because he deserved that.
Yeah.
He deserved that moment. And so that made me happier than the Deakins moment, just because he's 89 years old.
Yeah.
Give him that moment.
I agree. I just didn't realize that he never won. I just assumed that James Ivory has multiple Oscars. I just, you know what I mean? I just assumed that. Deakins, I've been following Deakins' career since pretty much the beginning, and he's always been one of my favorite cinematographers, so I know that he's never won. I just didn't know that about James Ivory. That's all. I plead ignorance on that.
And when you go back and look, you know, it's not like the guy doesn't have trophies for days of different kinds. Like, you've got all the BAFTAs and stuff one could ever want and other assorted things. But no, he didn't have one. And as
wow.
you pointed out, Ruth Prower Javala had a couple. And so that's fantastic. But no, that was great. And the two back-to-back standing ovations for Ivory and then for Jordan Peele, you don't see that on the screenwriting awards all that often at the Oscars, where both writers get standing ovations.
Yeah.
And that was so deserved on both counts.
Well, I agree. Overall, I thought it was fun, and we'll see what they do for next year. Okay, let's get to some of all the reviews that you've been writing about. You mentioned Rise, and I'm very, very curious about this. Tell everybody's new NBC's new show. Tell everybody what this is about.
Yes, if anyone watched a second of NBC's Olympics coverage, they almost inevitably saw multiple commercials for Rise during that time. So they already know that it's Ted Mosby from How I Met Your Mother as a theater director, and that's really what it is. I mean, if the commercials looked to you like Friday Night Lights meets Glee with Ted Mosby from How I Met Your Mother as a theater director, that's really exactly what the show is. And I've seen the entire first season, and so I can sort of say, and I know that people hate hearing this about TV shows because no one's got the patience of a TV critic, But it starts off really rough, and eventually it becomes the show you want it to be, probably. But it's hard for me to tell anyone, oh, have the patience. It's a really, really bad pilot. The first three or four episodes are really annoying. They don't know what to do with Josh Radnor for at least six or seven episodes, and he's playing like the most self-serious, insufferable version of Ted Mosby from How I Met Your Mother, and that's not a character anyone wants to spend time with no humor, and eventually they find a way to use him, but you got to go through a lot of rough stuff to get there. But I would say by the fifth or sixth episode, things started to click. And by the seventh or eighth episode, I was getting the sort of warm fuzzies I wanted. By the eighth or ninth episode, I was tearing up at you know, three or four moments per episode where they clearly wanted me to. And by the tenth episode, I was sort of on board. But it's rough, and it's rough for a few episodes. So you have to have patience with it. You have to like Spring Awakening. The plot is basically this group of high school students coached by a really insufferable teacher played by Josh Radnor. They put on a production of Spring Awakening, and you'll be shocked to discover, if anyone knows Spring Awakening, that this causes trouble with, you know, the principal and administrators and PTA and whatnot. But yeah, they play a lot of Spring Awakening. So if Spring Awakening is not a musical that does it for you, you're going to get sick of Spring Awakening in a real hurry. Yeah, so it takes a while to get there, and I don't know what I can ask of people in terms of their time commitment, because my time may not be meaningful, but people's time is.
And it follows This Is Us, and does it stay as following This Is Us, or are they just going to premiere it after This Is Us?
Yeah, they're premiering it after This Is Us, I believe after the finale of This Is Us, and then it moves up into the This Is Us time slot, because This Is Us is just done early, because they're doing a short-ish season.
Right.
So, yeah, it's getting sort of the advantage of that, plus the relentless advertising during the Olympics.
Yeah.
Really, pretty much nonstop. But yeah, there are some very good performances. Auli Cravallo, the lead actress from Moana, is just wonderful. She is such a pleasure to listen to and to watch, and she's great. Rosie Perez plays the teacher who, for no particular reason, Josh Radnor's character squeezes out of her job as the high school theater teacher or theater director, and she is very good, and you sort of root for her because he's so insufferable, and I don't know exactly how intentional that is, or if it's just the kind of thing that sort of happened. So yeah, let's see, who else is in it? Barb from Stranger Things.
Oh, okay.
Totally in it.
All right.
It's like not a huge part, but she's definitely there. So if you're one of those people who goes justice for Barb, and you really, really, really want to see what Barb is up to, what she's up to is Rise.
Okay. All right. And when does it premieres? I should know because, you know, I watch some of the Olympics and I watch NBC shows, and I should have at this point memorized when it debuts.
You should. No, March 13th.
March 13th. Okay.
Week.
All right. Next week. Okay, cool. All right. Okay, cool. Hang on a second, okay, Dan?
Sure.
All right, Dan's going to hang on, and we're going to have more TV talk. Dan Feinberg is the TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. We got more coming up right after this. Welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio right here, the Showcase studio right here on Michigan Avenue. And we're here until 5 a.m., Dan Feinberg is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. He joins us every other week to talk television. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And let's get back to it and talk more TV. All right, Dan, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, let's talk about Unsolved, the murders of Tupac and Notorious B.I.G. I have watched the first episode, and episode two is on my DVR. What do you think of this? Tell everybody about it.
Okay, so Unsolved is set in sort of three timelines. One of them is around 2006 and involves a detective put on the case of the unsolved murder of the Notorious B.I.G. That detective is played by Josh Duhamel, and he rounds up a team of
The investigators and others, led by Bokeem Woodbine most particularly, but other fine actors who you are almost certain to recognize work with him. So they're sort of following in the footsteps of the investigation from 1997-1998, tying into Biggie's death and beginning to investigate the possibility of connections to the murder of Tupac Shakur. And that murder was being investigated by a detective played by the great Jimmy Simpson. And so that's happening in 1996-97. And then in 1992-93, and then moving forward, it follows the fledgling relationship of a young Christopher Wallace, that being Biggie, mm-hmm. and a young Tupac, as they are initially friends, but then miscommunications and the nefarious Suge Knight and the bumbling idiocy of Sean Puffy Combs begin to eventually tear them apart, leading to tragedy. Spoiler alert.
Right.
So, yes, that is what Unsolved is about.
Yeah. Now, I watched the first episode, and how many of you have you seen the whole thing?
I have seen 7 of 10.
7 of 10. Okay. And I liked the first episode. I thought it you know, I was thinking to myself that they might have bitten off more than they could chew with the structure of it, going back and forth between these three timelines. And when it first started, I was, you know, when they cut back to 1992-93, because I didn't know the structure of it. I just knew what it was about. And I didn't know that they were going to be cutting back between three different timelines. And after they introduced, you know, the 97 timeline, and with the, as you mentioned, the great Jimmy Simpson, who is, I mean, at least in the first episode, phenomenal and clearly the most interesting person to watch on screen in the show. And I've always loved that guy. But, you know, once they did that, and then they went to the Josh Duhamel and said, "Hey, we're reopening the case. We want you to do that." But then when they jumped back and started the whole, you know, Tupac Biggie relationship, I was like, you know, this might be too much. But then, you know, as the first episode went along, I went with it. Now, and you know, I didn't think it was great. I know that clearly there are TV shows that are now going to be influenced by the success of The People versus O.J. Simpson, and this is clearly one of them. It's like it feels like USA doing an FX show. But I like the first episode. It's enough for me to be intrigued to watch the rest of it. Now, you've seen 7, so what do you think?
I've seen 7. I appreciate the structure. I appreciate the ambition of it. It was created by Kyle Long, who's been a writer on procedurals and stuff, and I appreciate the structure. I thought that a lot of the dialogue in both the first episodes and really all 7 I saw was pretty wretched. Like an awful lot of say, somebody going, we're investigating the murder of Christopher Wallace, to which at least 3 people on screen have to go, "You mean the notorious B.I.G.?" And the elaborate explanations people have to give for the East Coast-West Coast rap battle of the 90s. Right. Oh, with the East Coast rappers bickering with the West Coast rappers. And I understand that part of that is that these are storylines that are involving kind of middle-aged white cops in the 90s and the early 2000s, and they wouldn't necessarily know Tupac and Biggie, and that's fine. I thought a lot of the dialogue was horrible, but I liked the structure. Jimmy Simpson is great. To me, the crippling problem with the entire show is that they don't have the music. And so you've got Tupac and Biggie as characters, and you have people talking about their brilliance, but the show has no way of presenting their brilliance because they don't have the rights to their song.
Mm.
And if you don't know who Tupac and Biggie are coming into this, you are not going to know who they are coming out of it. And that's a big problem to me because they take up a lot of screen time, and there's a lot of time spent discussing their music and naming songs. And there's one episode which features the recording of the Biggie song Juicy, and all they can play is the musical hook at the beginning. They don't have anything that's after that. And then there's another scene which is set at the recording of the video for Juicy, and all they have again is the opening music, but none of the actual rapping. And it to me, that really kind of cripples the show, is that you just don't have the music that this needs as a spine. But it's interesting, and I think if you don't know the story at all, you aren't going to find out about Tupac and Biggie, but it's an interesting look at sort of 90s and early aughts LA police work and race relations and power and all of that stuff. It's interesting. It's definitely not People versus O.J. Simpson.
Right. Okay. You know, I never, you know, I never really thought about it. I mean, that is a big deal for them not to have the music. That's a huge deal. Was it a few years ago they made a biopic of Jimi Hendrix? And wasn't it from Outkast?
Yes,
Andre 3000. He played.
I did not see.
He played Jimi Hendrix. They didn't have a right. They didn't have the rights to any Hendrix songs, which was a huge issue. Obviously,
it is. And you know, in this case, there are obviously reasons why, and the respective families have given the rights to some things and not given the rights to other things. And this is not necessarily the most positive look at either man necessarily, though I think it's a pretty rosy picture of both of them.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, you know, and I'm sure money also plays into it as well to some degree. It, to me, it's a really big stumbling block, and I kind of wonder if this is the sort of thing where they needed to make sure they had at least something in their back pocket before they made the thing at all, and they didn't. And so you're left with a lot of more generic kind of background hip-hop from the period, but there's just no Tupac and there's just no Biggie, and that's not great.
Yeah, no, that's a big deal. All right, Dan, hang on.
Sure.
Dan Feinberg is with us. We have to take a break for the news here, and then we'll come back and we'll talk more with Dan Feinberg. Joins us every couple of weeks to talk TV. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. More TV talk after the news right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio, and we're here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and Justin Kaufman is in for Steve Cochran this morning for your morning drive at 6. It's Thursday. That means Triple Play Thursday. And Triple Play Thursday. And that means it's one artist, three songs. And you can call up and request. We'll play them later. 312-981-7200. We're going to have another edition of Pop-Up Video coming up. Skip's on the way. And we're going to talk about firsts. First cars, first jobs, first dates, first this, first that, all that kind of fun stuff, and we'll reminisce a little bit about those kind of things. Right now, though, Dan Feinberg joins us. He's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. He joins us every couple of weeks to talk TV. Lots of TV to talk about. Let's welcome Dan back. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you much.
All right. I am very interested in Life Sentence for some reason, and I think it's because I'm a fan of Lucy Hale. So
I like the way you paused, though. There was I'm very interested in Life Sentence for some reason.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I don't know what to make of the plot and the trailer and everything, but I really like Lucy Hale a lot, and I've liked her in a lot of the stuff that she's done in the past. And so it's an interesting idea for a show. Tell everybody about it.
The idea of the show basically is Lucy Hale plays a young woman who basically was living with a terminal cancer diagnosis for years, and her family dedicated their lives to sort of making her last years special, and she had a whirlwind romance with a British guy she met in Paris, and she was expecting that, you know, she was in her last 6 months, and then she gets to the doctor, and the doctor tells her she's cured. And so the question is, what do you do when you've basically been living like you were dying for so long? What do you do when you suddenly discover that you're living? And part of the complication is that when all of her family members no longer need to concentrate on making her happy and making her life smooth, suddenly she realizes and they realize how messy their lives are and how little care they've taken of themselves. And so she basically decides to be the manic pixie dream girl for all of them and dedicate her life to facilitating all of their returns to happiness and stability and whatnot. And whatever the show is, and the show is so thin, you know, basically it starts with a premise that's life and death. This is a young woman who's certain she's going to die. They eliminate that set of stakes, and then from there, there's really nothing keeping the show going along. It's impossible to care particularly about anything, because once she's survived cancer, everything's pretty much going to be mostly okay, and that's what the show is she's making things mostly okay for herself and others. But if you are a fan of Lucy Hale, she absolutely is a fantastic star for this particular kind of vehicle. This is sort of the kind of thing that the old WB used to do, and it's warm and fuzzy again, and it's a little bit funny. It's actually probably more funny when all is said and done than it is emotional. And she's just very, very capable of doing this. She's amazingly expressive. She's got these huge eyes that seem to take up the entire screen. She's very good with comedy. When things get emotional, her eyes brim up with tears beautifully, and you want to go, oh, I feel so sorry. She's an anime character brought to life, which is exactly what the show needs. And if the show around her, were any less interesting, it wouldn't exist at all. There would be no show. If the show around her were significantly better, maybe it would be a very good show. As it stands, I do think she's very good, and she's completely watchable at all times, and whatever dumb things the character is doing, it's just really hard to care about anything else.
Yeah.
And so, you know, she is the show, and she's on the screen a lot of the time, but she's not on the screen all of the time, and she's got a really boring family that feel like they have to be involved in A stories and B stories and stuff, and you're kind of like, okay, go away and just let Lucy Hale be adorable, and she does that with aplomb, but the show around her is otherwise forgettable, and it's just hard to get deeply emotionally involved. On the other hand, because of her, it's a hard show to dislike.
Okay. Well, I happen to be a huge fan of hers, so...
I think that for people who are fans of hers, the show is not painful around her, even if it's negligible, and so you can just concentrate on her and enjoy what she's doing, and I think that probably she is a fantastic CW TV star, and she was previously a very fine Freeform or ABC Family TV star. You know, I don't know that we will ever see her become a huge movie star or an FX star or an HBO star, but in certain vehicles, she is completely and totally a TV star.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. I'm glad to hear at least she's good in it.
So, indeed.
Okay. Okay. Let's hear your review of what I think might be the worst idea for a TV series.
Wait a second. We already talked about Deception.
Okay. No. Well, this is the okay. Well, here's what I'll say. Worst idea for a reboot of a movie. Paramount Network's Heathers. When I saw that they were doing a TV series of Heathers, my heart just sunk. One, because I love that movie, and I think it doesn't need to be touched in any way, shape, or form, or tried to be improved upon or extended in any possible way. And then when I actually saw, you know, the trailer for it, and Shannon Doherty's actually in it, I was like, this is just no. So where do you stand on Heathers?
Well, I mean, on the bright side, I at least temporarily killed this one. I feel like I have to take some responsibility, because my review was one of the first to come out, and the show is awful, and my review was a very heavy pan, and within 24 hours of my review going up, Paramount pulled the show and said it will premiere sometime later this year, and the official reason was, of course, out of sensitivity to the victims of the Parkland shooting and all of that, and that's it's completely viable, except for the fact that they decided to pull it two solid weeks after the Parkland shooting and 6 days after they had already put the pilot online and gone to the trouble of letting people know they could watch the pilot already online.
Yeah.
So 7 days after Parkland, they were perfectly prepared to put this show online.
Right.
And so I don't want to impugn their motives too much, but the motives are suspect, and the show itself is just awful. It's not funny. It's not exciting. It has a semi-interesting take on the main characters, which is basically that instead of being these beautiful, preppy, popular girls, It's people who, in movies of the 80s, would have been outsiders. So one of the Heathers is a gay guy. One of them is a biracial lesbian. The lead Heather is quote unquote body positive, as we say. And so it's about reversing the power structure of high school. But then it becomes this weird thing where the previously bullied become bullies in the name of political correctness, and you wonder if the entire purpose of the show is to make fun of identity politics and what the point is that they think they're making in that case. Is it about how people who are politically correct have become the true bullies? Because I don't think that's the point that the creators think that they're making, but it's sure the point that comes through. Then you have a ridiculously boring Veronica, and the JD is even more boring than the Veronica. And I think that's a pretty fair interpretation, to sort of go and look and say, okay, today's version of JD would sort of be like a, kind of a dickhead, Reddit commenter, and he would probably be a Gamergate, you know, sort of sexist, annoying internet troll,
right,
to some degree.
Right.
And it's a viable interpretation. It's just a boring interpretation, and he's still there, and the lead guy is this bland actor who could have appeared on 75 CW shows and not made a mark. The whole show is a disaster. It has no perspective at all.
Does Daniel Waters have anything to do with it?
Oh, no.
Okay, good.
Well, except in the sense that he's presumably getting a large amount of money because large chunks of the dialogue are lifted directly from the movie, and every time they insert a line from the movie into the series, you're reminded of how the lines that Daniel Waters wrote were brilliant
and
had actual calculation and rhythm, and they took, visceral pleasure in the obscenities and the fun of the language, and this is just cheap and tawdry and lurid, and the take on school violence is utterly superficial. The fifth episode, which was the last that I saw, features the JD character playing a school shooting simulation game, which was already going to cause a pretty huge amount of trouble because, unfortunately, tragically, have these things with some regularity, and so they were going to have a hard time airing that episode anyway. I don't know. This is an awful show, and it does not, to my mind, do anything good for the fledgling Paramount brand to put this on the air. It's so bad, and they're going to have a hard time putting it on the air. But I also thought that there was zero chance that USA would ever be able to air Shooter, their Ryan Phillippe version of the Mark Wahlberg. I thought there was zero chance they would ever get long enough between shootings for that thing to air.
Yeah.
And remarkably, it's aired two seasons and been renewed for a third, which blows my mind, but apparently they were able to do it. So if Paramount feels like they want to put their name on it, they could still air.
You know, it's interesting and sad about what's happening in this world, and then how the entertainment world is responding to it, because they delayed the release of Eli Roth's ridiculous remake of Death Wish, which was of course shot here, which we're all real proud of. they delayed that because of Vegas, and then they end up releasing it now, but it gets to the point where it's like, well, it doesn't matter because there's going to be another shooting in 2 months. You know what I mean? That's how sad it is right now. It's like, just release the Death Wish movie. If we wait another 2 months, there's going to be another shooting anyway. That's kind of what it feels like. That's kind of what it feels like.
Which is awful.
Absolutely.
It absolutely feels like that way. And that's when you start going, okay, if you're the person who has the power to make these decisions and to put X number of million dollars behind these ideas, how comfortable do you feel putting X number of million dollars behind a project that you know has, these inevitable, tragic stumbling blocks in front of it, and especially if it's not gonna have anything to say. And that's the thing, is that the original movie uses these quote-unquote suicides and murders to sort of delve into something interesting about teenagers facing mortality for the first time.
Oh, yeah.
What it means when you actually have real death in front of you.
Yeah.
How do you respond?
Yeah.
And the fact is there's a generation of high school students now who have spent their entire educational careers doing school shooting drills regularly. They face mortality anytime they turn on the news. They yep. face mortality as a drill. And I think there is a version of Heather's that if someone was smart and mostly just smart, honestly, that's what it is. If someone was smart enough to say, what can I do that would actually reflect this generation that would say something about school shooting and say something about how teens today approach mortality, but this is not that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's just a huge wasted opportunity.
Yeah, and I just don't, because Heather's, I think Heather's is just a brilliant movie. Absolutely brilliant and so funny and so smart and again, takes on something in a way that it's dark. It's obviously a completely pitch black comedy, but it's got something to say, and it says it intelligently, and I think with a lot of emotion as well. I adore the movie, and when I heard that they were going to try to do something now with it, we don't know when it's going to air, but don't worry about it because it's bad.
Avoid at all costs.
Okay. Before we let you out of here, we have to have our biweekly little discussion about baskets. did you see this week's episode?
Oh, I've been watching Louis Anderson saying Lo Mein.
I know.
For like all morning, I rewatched that scene. Yes, the Vegas trip was great, and the week before with Thanksgiving was even better.
Beautiful. I like the fact that Martha got a nice chunk of the episode this week.
But the past 2 weeks, and we keep saying this, and so we're just going to keep saying it. It's Christine's show. It's yeah. Louis Anderson's show, and yeah. I don't even think at this point that FX has any justifiable way of even pretending that he's not a lead actor on the show.
Yeah.
So, and I don't know that anyone would feel like he was anything other than worthy of a nomination in the lead category. So I would hope that FX will do the right thing and let Louis be the lead, because he has been and has been so great. Vegas episode was wonderful, and I think I preferred the Thanksgiving episode, but the Vegas episode was great.
This whole season has just been fantastic.
And so. how about Atlanta while we're
oh please please oh man, obviously I've only seen the first episode because it airs tonight. The second episode airs tonight, but the first episode was spectacular. I just so great. And I just, that opening sequence alone, I was like, oh my God. It blew me away.
It's just a what the heck is this show? And the answer continues to be it's whatever it wants to be. Yeah. I've only seen two episodes. The second episode is much funnier than the first.
Okay.
the first episode I thought was on the less funny side.
Yeah.
Not to say that Florida Man, for example, was not side-splittingly hilarious.
It was.
but the episode felt more towards the dramatic side. The second episode feels more towards the comedic side.
Okay. I will have to say this. The casting of Cat Williams was genius. Was absolute genius, man. I don't know.
He is really good. They used him really well. But the Lakeith Stanfield Florida Man thing was worth the entire season. I don't need any more episodes. The whole season was worth it.
No, it's great. I mean, it's the best. It's the best. I think it's the best show on TV. It's only one episode in, but I think it's the best show on TV. So
I agree.
All right. Okay. Dan, always a pleasure. And we will talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good, Nick.
All right, cool. Dan Feinberg. By the way, if you're not watching Atlanta on FX, you should just throw your TV out the window. That's kind of how I feel. Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, FIEN. We're going to take a break. We'll be back after this on 720 WGN.